Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
The search widens for a missing Malaysian plane, and thousands march in a Turkish teen's funeral. I'm Frances Alonso reporting from Washington. International teams searching for a missing Malaysian passenger jet widened their search area today as Malaysian authorities denied issuing conflicting information about the last known location of flight MH370. Marianne Brown reports.
Speaking at a news conference in Kuala Lumpur Wednesday, Malaysia Transport Minister Hisham Amuddin Hussein said Malaysia is dealing with an unprecedented situation and will do whatever it takes to find the Malaysia Airlines Boeing 777 that went missing Saturday.
And I give you my assurance that it will not reduce the tempo and that we will not spare any effort to find the missing plane.
The minister said 42 ships and 39 aircraft from 12 countries have so far found nothing in their search. Marianne Browns in Hanoi.
U.S. President Barack Obama is hosting Ukraine's interim prime minister at the White House today. It comes as a standoff between Russia and the West over the Ukrainian region of Crimea continues. This is President Obama's first meeting with interim prime minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk, and it's meant to underscore U.S. support for the new government and the Ukrainian people. The Ukrainian interim prime minister's visit to Washington comes as Crimea prepares for a Moscow-backed referendum Sunday on joining Russia. In a statement released today, the leaders of the Group of Seven leading industrialized nations called on Russia to, in their words, cease all efforts to change the status of Crimea contrary to Ukrainian law and in violation of international law, and to immediately halt actions supporting the referendum on Crimea's future status. The G7 includes Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the United States. Tens of thousands of people chanting anti-government slogans marched through central Istanbul today for the funeral of a Turkish teenager wounded in street protests last summer, whose death has sparked renewed unrest across Turkey. Riot police fired tear gas to disperse tens of thousands of protesters in the capital of Ankara and as well as the coastal city of Izmir. It comes a day after 15-year-old Berkan Elvan's death on Tuesday. Some protesters hurled stones at a ruling party building, smashing its windows. Opposition activists say Islamist militants and their local supporters have killed at least 25 people in a village in northern Syria near the Turkish border. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights told VOA that militants from the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant killed 14 fighters from rival rebel groups, at least 9 local tribesmen and 2 children. South African police forensics analyst says Oscar Pistorius was probably not wearing his prosthetic legs when he used a cricket bat to hit the door through which he fatally shot his girlfriend. It's an assertion that counters claims made by the athlete. In court testimony today, Johannes Vermeulen said he believes Pistorius was on his stumps when he used the bat to try to break open the door last year after fatally shooting Riva Stenkamp.
As I said in my evidence in chief, the marks matched with in a natural position without the legs of Mr. Pistorius. That the marks is consistent with him being in a natural position without these prostheses.
Meanwhile, Pistorius's lawyer, in cross-examining Vermeulen, said the defense team could show the same marks can be made by someone in a standing position. The head of the newly established commission of inquiry that will probe atrocities in South Sudan has pledged to leave no stone unturned as a panel investigates alleged human rights violations and other abuses. Former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo spoke today shortly after the 5-member African Union Commission was sworn in. He said both Africans and non-Africans worldwide would be watching how his panel approached its work. Hong Kong police say 9 people have been arrested in connection with a vicious attack on a former newspaper editor. Kevin Lau received serious wounds to his torso and legs after being attacked last month by a man with a meat cleaver. The police commissioner said today that mainland authorities arrested 2 men, while Hong Kong police arrested 7 others. I'm Frances Alonso, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
East African leaders will meet in Ethiopia on Thursday to discuss the mandate and size of a stabilization and protection force to be deployed in South Sudan.
That's Marta van der Wolf reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, Libya's former prime minister violates a travel ban and has left the country. A study considers women's food choices amid rising education and income levels. And a unique partnership works to prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV/AIDS in Nigeria. We'll have these stories and more all coming up on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, former Libyan Prime Minister Ali Zaidan has violated a travel ban and left the country. His departure came hours after the National Congress gave him a no-confidence vote. Malta State Radio reported Zaidan made a brief stop on the Mediterranean island before traveling on. His destination was not reported. The National Congress yesterday swore in Defense Minister Abdullaha Al-Tini. The no-confidence vote came 2 hours after reports that a North Korea-flagged oil tanker carrying oil bought from rebels in the port of Al-Sidra eluded Libya's navy. Loss of the vessel was one of a series of disappointments for the interim government. Al-Tini will serve for 2 weeks while a divided assembly selects a replacement for Zaidan. The assembly has been deadlocked between Islamist and non-Islamist blocs after writing a new constitution and establishing a date for national elections. East African leaders will meet in Ethiopia tomorrow to discuss the mandate and size of a stabilization and protection force to be deployed in South Sudan. Marta van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
Heads of state of the East African bloc IGAD, which has been mediating talks between South Sudan's warring sides, are now turning attention to troop deployment. Ethiopian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Dina Mufti says the extraordinary summit is devoted just to South Sudan.
They'll be talking about the deployment of forces to the region, which most of them have agreed, because there is going to be a deployment of the African brigades from all IGAD countries plus two other non-IGAD members, Burundi and Rwanda.
Other countries that have said they are ready to send troops to South Sudan are Ethiopia, Kenya and Djibouti. The presence of Ugandan troops in the country from the beginning of the conflict has led to criticism by the opposition side and the international community that they are an obstacle to a peaceful solution. So Uganda's troop will slowly be withdrawn. Fighting broke out in South Sudan mid-December after a dispute within the ruling SPLM. The dispute led to fighting between forces of President Salva Kiir and soldiers loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. A January ceasefire hasn't taken hold, so regional leaders are determining how best to reinforce the truce. Dina Mufti says they're looking at how many troops will be needed and the extent of their mandate.
This is a kind of peacekeeping force, so they are going to reinforce or realize the cessation of hostility. They'll help in that process. They'll help the monitors and the people who verify the cessation of hostilities or the ceasefire.
After IGAD heads of state decide on the mandate and the size of the force, the African Union and the United Nations will need to give approval before the force can actually be deployed. The conflict in South Sudan has killed thousands of people and displaced close to a million. To ensure the participation of the South Sudanese people in the peace process, a civil society conference will be held in Addis Ababa after the IGAD summit. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
9 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Mali's National Assembly is expected to discuss the creation of a Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission this week. Human rights groups have expressed concern that the proposed commission will not have the necessary independence to make a difference. VOA's Anne Look has more from our West Africa Bureau.
New Mali is a work in progress. The crisis of 2012 and 2013 divided the country like never before, both literally and figuratively. A French-led military intervention may have physically reunited much of the country early last year, but communal divisions are far from healed. President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita says national reconciliation is a top priority. But first, Malians must figure out what exactly happened and why. This week, the National Assembly will debate the legal framework to create a commission to do just that. The proposed commission would have 3 years to explore crimes committed during this most recent crisis and during previous conflicts in the north. It would go back as far as independence in 1960. A previous commission created last year by the former interim government accomplished little. Its failings left Malians doubting the very idea. Human rights groups say this time the commission must be seen as impartial and representative. Attorney Mokhtar Mariko is head of the Malian Association for Human Rights. He says the mandate of the commission needs to be clearly spelled out, and the men and women who lead it cannot have been implicated in the crimes that were committed throughout the country. He says this commission must be truly independent. There is talk of attaching the commission to the relatively new Ministry of Reconciliation and Development for the North. Mariko says that's a bad idea, as it would open the commission up to political interference. The proposed commission would have 15 members and 7 working groups. International rights group Human Rights Watch says Malians should get a say in those appointed. The group says there should be a wide consultation with civil society, political parties, and other groups, along with public confirmation hearings. Human Rights Watch is also calling for the commission to have investigative powers that would allow it to refer cases to the criminal justice system and recommend reparations for victims. The proposed commission would be called the Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission. Many Malians say that is exactly the order in which things must happen for this initiative to succeed. Truth, justice, then reconciliation. Anne Luk, VOA News, Dakar.
In many middle and low income countries, obesity levels rise along with income. But a new study says the better educated women are, the better their chances of avoiding obesity. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Dr. Amina Etsy-Selmi is the lead author of the University College London study. She wanted to know if trends in high-income countries could be found elsewhere.
We know that in high-income countries, education and income tend to go together, and that those who are most educated and have the highest income tend to be the thinnest, and the opposite being true.
The study looked at the middle-income countries of Egypt, Jordan, and Colombia, and the low-income countries of Nigeria, India, and Benin. These are countries where income levels are on the rise. As a result, women are buying higher-calorie foods. Researchers call them energy-dense foods. Simply put, they can pack on the pounds because they're often laden with sugar, salt, and fat. These can be processed foods or so-called fast foods.
The study shows that although higher income or higher wealth seems to be correlated with a greater risk of obesity in women in middle-income countries and low-income countries as well, in middle-income countries, something strange happened in that education seemed to start protecting against this effect, so that women with higher education weren't affected by this wealth effect that made other women more obese.
She says there may be a few explanations for this.
It could be that more educated women just have different body shape preferences. They're more in contact with Western images of beauty, which promote thinness. It could also be that they have better health understanding, different time preferences, so they kind of invest in future health.
But the link between education, wealth, and health appears a bit different in low-income countries. It may have to do with past economic conditions, when many types of high-calorie foods were scarce. The desire for those foods now may outweigh the protective education effect seen in middle- and high-income countries.
The greater scarcity means that obesity is just not an issue in that kind of environment. Any advantage you might have socioeconomically, whether it's higher education or higher wealth, might be used to be able to access a greater quantity of food. And the market isn't as complex as a middle-income country where you have lots of products and there are lots of decisions to be made, and that's where education may start to kick in, something that helps consumers to make decisions.
Also, low-income countries may not have public health systems in place to deal with growing obesity levels. Obesity has been linked to such non-communicable diseases as cancer, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. Dr. H.C. Selmy says more study is needed on what she calls the interplay between education and the wider environment.
Interventions could target either the education side of things to encourage women's education or health knowledge. I mean, we need to look in more detail on the pathways that link education to obesity. Or it could be to do with the general environment and the kind of information that is in the environment, and that in some ways puts those who don't have education at a disadvantage because the signals that are coming from the environment might promote unhealthy behaviors like overconsumption.
That environmental information may include multimedia advertisements, which tell consumers fast food is delicious, cheap, and easy to get. They often lack details on the food's nutritional value. She says education can be a good defense against unhealthy food choices.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. If you understand the risks that are around you and how your decisions affect your health, then you'll probably make different decisions.
H.C. Selmy is a Wellcome Trust Fellow at University College London. The study appears in Plus One. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A South African police forensics analyst says Oscar Pistorius was probably not wearing his prosthetic legs when he used a cricket bat to hit the door through which he fatally shot his girlfriend, an assertion that counters claims made by the athlete. In court testimony today, Johannes Vermeulen said he believes Pistorius was on his stumps when he used the bat to try to break open the door last year after fatally shooting Reva Steenkamp. The door was set up in the courtroom as Vermeulen described how marks on the bat matched one smaller and one larger hole in the door. Pistorius said in an affidavit during a bail hearing last year that he had put on the prosthetics prior to hitting the door with a cricket bat. His lawyer, in cross-examining Vermeulen, said the defense team could show the same marks can be made by someone in a standing position. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 18 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Libya's former prime minister violates a travel ban and has left the country. East African leaders will meet in Ethiopia tomorrow to discuss the mandate and size of a stabilization and protection force to be deployed in South Sudan. And a study considers women's food choices amid rising education and income levels. And of course, we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237. Well, South Africa's Johannesburg is chatty and concise. According to a new study, the city's metro area averages one geotagged tweet every 13 seconds, leading the African continent in Twitter usage. Using 140 characters or less, users in the metro area posted 608,387,000 geotagged tweets over a three-month span, the study found. Peter Cox reports from Johannesburg on the tweeting trends of Africa.
It's not a huge surprise that Johannesburg sends out tweets more frequently than any other city in Africa. That's what the How Africa Tweets survey from Portland Communications found after looking at Twitter statistics from October to December in 2013. Johannesburg is an economic leader in Africa, and South Africa has the highest smartphone penetration of any nation on the continent. Alan Kamau heads the Nairobi office for Portland Communications.
Also, Egypt featured highly. Cairo, Alexandria, other top cities in terms of active tweeting. Moving to East Africa, Nairobi is the most active, not surprising. It's sixth most active on the continent.
The study was conducted by sorting through all geotagged Twitter posts. That means that a user allows their device to show their location or puts location information into their tweet. So these numbers don't necessarily reflect the total amount of tweets out of each city. But Kamau says they do give a reliable estimate for the amount of Twitter usage.
It should be a broad indicator of, you know, the trends within the Twitter sphere. It's representative enough for it to be a broad kind of indicator of Twitter activity, trends in terms of how people are using it.
The company has done the survey twice now, and Kamau said the largest change he's seen is how Twitter is being used.
In terms of topics, one of the shifts that we've seen is, you know, when we look at our survey in 2012, that it was very much social conversations online. We're seeing much more corporate, so many more companies having a presence online. So brands having a greater share of voice, being more active, engaging consumers directly.
He said consumers are also using Twitter to air out issues with bad products or services, not only with companies, but government as well.
It's a much more public place, and also it's a direct channel, you know, it's a direct and public channel to complain, and people organize very well, as you know, on social media.
Kamau says companies, governments, and organizations, even sports teams, see great potential in marketplace engagement. The top topic of Twitter across the continent is football.
Africans love football, are very passionate about their football teams, and, you know, Twitter provides a platform, again, for fans to get behind their team. So, you know, the most mentioned football team is Johannesburg's Orlando Pirates. And I think, you know, it's just a fantastic platform for that kind of thing.
Mickey Modisane, public relations director for the Orlando Pirates, agrees. The team's Twitter handle has 145,000 followers and is used frequently.
Sometimes we tweet close to about 15 to 20 times in a day. With regard to, it could be about players' availability ahead of the match, ticket sales, PR activities, PR campaigns.
He's happy that his team is one of the most talked about teams on Twitter.
For us, we're quite excited. It simply means there's something good that we're doing as far as social network is concerned, you know, and as far as Twitter is concerned, because we definitely engage our fans.
That might be something to tweet about. Peter Cox for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Well, prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV/AIDS, PMTCT, is the goal of a unique partnership in Nigeria, where nearly 70,000 babies are born with the illness every year. The global oil company Chevron has partnered with local nonprofit organizations in Bayelsa State to generate pilot programs that address prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV/AIDS. The company says prevention is the key to realizing an AIDS-free generation. Deji Hostrup is General Manager of Policy, Government and Public Affairs of Chevron Nigeria Limited. He spoke with me about how their partnering with the local community is proving successful in helping to prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS.
We've been committed to these PMTCT program, that's prevention of mother to child transmission of HIV. In 2011, we pledged $20 million to the UN's mission to eliminate the mother-to-child transmission of HIV by 2015. Since that time, we surpassed our original pledge by committing $26.1 million to programs and partnerships with PACT, the Business Leadership Council, that's BLC, and the Global Fund. And this will help to eliminate vertical transmission of HIV in Angola, Nigeria, and South Africa. And in all these countries, we have substantial presence.
How were you able to mobilize people on the ground to get this program going?
Our partner in this venture is PACT. PACT has tried and tested experience in regards to mobilizing local communities. And so we're very proud of the partnership we've been able to forge with PACT. The Bayelsa State Ministry of Health is also involved in this, and also the Bayelsa State Action Committee on AIDS, which is known locally here as BACA. These grassroots involvement in projects such as this ensures stakeholder buy-in right from the start and a very high likelihood of project success, and more importantly, the sustainability.
Looking at the success of this program, what have been the results of doing this?
In the first year, PROMO has achieved remarkable results. First of all, 4 community-based organizations have been trained to support the prevention of mother-to-child transmission outreach. This is important, as I said, for sustainability. 148 local health workers have received close to 6,000 hours of training through this project. About 6,500 individuals have been reached throughout Bayelsa State, and more than 7,000 women have been tested for HIV during antenatal care. About 700 people currently receive HIV counseling. These are substantial results.
And looking at how you are reaching people, such as the outreach aspect of it, how are you getting to people in remote areas? Are the clinics actually set up there, or how do people reach the clinics so that they can get the health care that they need?
There are clinics that treat pregnant women that are already there. It's just the aspect of educating people, helping them to understand the need to get tested early, and if they test positive, how to prevent transmission to the unborn child. That's the challenge that we face. Of course, this is a little bit of a challenging area. It's a very remote terrain where most of the settlements, communities and villages are in swampy areas. But this is an area that PACT is quite familiar with, and they're working, as I said, with local community-based organizations to reach those who need to be reached.
I understand that mobile technology has also played a key role in the success of this program. So how has that helped?
The rollout of the mobile phone data collection is a reminder system that PACT has developed as part of the PROMOTE project. It provides health education messaging by texting SMS messages through mobile phones. It also tracks women and infant pairs. It provides reminders on timely attendance at antenatal care, which is something that you have to remind those in these rural communities about. It also shares the protocol for safe delivery and exclusive breastfeeding practices. These are all done through the mobile phone applications that have been put in place. It's really helping.
What are your goals for this year, and are there any other countries that you are looking at to do this work?
Currently, the prevalence of HIV in this part of the country is such that we have enough on our hands currently. And so what we're hoping to do is to scale up and deepen the successes that has already been accomplished. We want to be sure that this program is sustainable. And a major focus of PROMOTE is to reduce the stigma that surrounds HIV/AIDS, both at the health facility level and at the community level.
That was Zeji Hostrup, General Manager of Policy, Government and Public Affairs of Chevron Nigeria Limited. He spoke with me from Lagos, Nigeria. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Jackson Mfugani, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can the AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at UpfrontAfrica.